It's Thursday, April 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, disclosures about prominent Chinese families are among the revelations contained in the Panama Papers.
There are still many ways to get around things, to hide your money, and you can still get away with it.
Dutch voters reject a treaty with Ukraine. And country music fans mourn the death of singer Merle Haggard. It's all ahead. Relatives of the Chinese Communist Party's top leadership, including the country's president, are among those mentioned in the massive leak of records concerning offshore bank accounts from a Panamanian firm. I spoke with VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide and asked him about the reaction in China to the disclosures.
Well, we've had pretty much a blackout on the internet. Officials are moving quickly to censor any details or information about this. Some stories are getting through. People are obviously talking about it on social media because there continues to be postings that are blocked. But you can see those with the help of some sites in Hong Kong and elsewhere, that such as freeweibo.com, that help you see comments that are being censored. So that's going on. And as far as at the government level, there's pretty much been silence. The foreign ministry declined to comment on this and said that the information in the documents that was linking the family members of high-ranking officials to offshore holdings was just groundless.
There have been reports before, I think by the New York Times and Bloomberg, about the accumulation of wealth by relatives of high-ranking Chinese officials. But this latest information, I mean, this involves relatives of President Xi Jinping, also of former Premier Li Peng, to say nothing of an in-law of the founder of the People's Republic of China, Mao Zedong himself.
Yeah, this is very broad. I mean, it goes right from the start to the present, really. This ton of documents that has been leaked really touches on almost all the eras of Chinese leadership. I mean, even Hu Yaobang, who was premier in the 80s, his son was also among those who information was provided about his offshore holdings. And so it really seems like almost no one is untouched. And really, you know, that's long been the situation. And the public here knows that high-ranking officials, there's a lot of abuse and corruption. And that's why Xi Jinping has been waging this huge anti-corruption campaign. But the problem is that, and as we see from these revelations, is that there are still many ways to get around things, to hide your money, and you can still get away with it. And, you know, it could be those who are currently in power. I mean, we have three current standing Politburo committee members, this top political body in China, that are listed among those, the family members of those who are listed in these documents that are revealed. So it really shows just how prevalent the problem is.
In recent years, there's been discussion about how China has accumulated a great amount of wealth. A number of people have had bank accounts, financial dealings outside the country, and a number of Chinese have actually moved their, if not residency, their financial holdings outside of the country. I mean, this must come at a bit of a sensitive time for Chinese, especially those who are not as well off, who their families and what money they have remains in the country.
It certainly does. With the slowing economy, with concern about jobs, and seeing how the party has, or those, the family members of those in the party leadership have benefited apparently from their position. Obviously, we don't have any clear connections between wrongdoing yet that have emerged from the leakage of the documents. The only ones that really kind of seem that there's a direct connection between corruption are the documents that are related to Gu Kailai, the wife of Bo Xilai, and both of them are in prison now. So it really, and that's probably why officials are cracking down so hard and trying to control the flow of this information. And China has been waging this campaign against corruption, but it's always been at their own pace and in a very controlled manner. You mentioned earlier about, you know, the New York Times and Bloomberg, how they have written these big exposés about the financial holdings and the investments of the family members of high-ranking Communist Party leaders. And we've seen what's happened in those cases. Their websites have been blocked. Journalists working for those organizations have been refused visas.
That's VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, Bernie Sanders made a comment yesterday that he said Hillary Clinton was not qualified to be president.
Oh.
And so this sparked a hashtag that is still trending this morning, hashtag Hillary So Qualified. A number of Hillary supporters noting her accomplishments, people even going saying, Hillary's so qualified, I'm going to donate some money to her, posting a screenshot of the donation email. But then Bernie Sanders supporters went and took that hashtag and kind of hijacked it. And so they said, Hillary's so qualified because she has all these Wall Street donors and all her, you know, Wall Street friends. Or Hillary's so qualified because she used to be a Republican when she was younger. So it's this back and forth on social media, but it shows how quickly these things can develop, and sometimes in a negative way, even if they start out positive, especially in the political climate when you have so much back and forth and so many strong emotions about some of these candidates. So that's trending this morning. Also trending today is World Health Day.
Yeah.
So hashtag World Health Day. We're seeing a lot of pledges of people to get in shape, saying I'm going to exercise more, I'm going to eat well. One statistic I saw, it's kind of jarring, is that in the past 35 years, the number of people worldwide with diabetes has risen from about 100 million to nearly half a billion. So it's grown quadrupled in the past 35 years. They're saying that is the new health crisis, obesity, and trying to get people to eat better. Curiously, it's also hashtag National Beer Day. So people are saying it's kind of an odd... The same day as World Health Day is National Beer Day. People saying, well, there's some health benefits to moderate drinking, but we're seeing with that a lot of people saying, well, these are my favorite beers. I'm going to go out to happy hour this evening. But not lost on people that these two hashtags are right next to each other on Twitter and trending at the same time. So people saying, maybe, hey, maybe it's not such a bad thing to go out and have a drink and relax, as long as you don't drink too much.
Right. And we will be having a report on World Health Day later on in the program. Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
California scientists have found that people who frequently check their Facebook pages may not be doing so because they enjoy the interactivity of social media, but because they may not be getting enough sleep. After analyzing data collected from 76 undergraduate students, researchers from the University of California, Irvine, say that they found a direct link between chronic lack of sleep, a bad mood, and increased dependence on checking out Facebook pages. The study also showed a link between sleep deprivation and being distracted. According to the study's lead researcher, Gloria Mark, if someone is distracted, they often go online and check their Facebook page because it's easy and they're tired. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has called sleep deprivation a public health epidemic. Lack of sleep has been linked to potentially life-threatening incidents like car and industrial accidents. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we hear why the disease diabetes is a growing health threat. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko has vowed to strengthen his country's ties with the European Union despite Wednesday's rejection of a political, trade, and defense treaty with Kiev by voters in the Netherlands. All 28 EU members must approve the treaty for it to have legal force. Turnout for the vote barely exceeded the 30% threshold required for it to be valid. Of those casting ballots in the non-binding referendum, 61% said no, while 38% said yes. Dutch Foreign Minister Bert Koenders said further discussions will now be necessary.
This is an important political fact. It means that the ratification cannot proceed as was expected before. So we have to take a step-by-step approach. We have now to talk within the cabinet, with the parliament, with our European partners, also with the Ukraine, to see what the consequences of this decision might be. We will take some time for that because it requires negotiation with all these actors. And therefore, I request also a little bit of patience of everybody. And then we will come back to a further reaction.
Dutch Socialist Parliamentarian Harry van Brummel said the government should break off the ratification process and go back to Brussels to make it a regular trade agreement with Ukraine, not a political agreement. Desmond Dynan, a public policy professor at George Mason University in Virginia, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the referendum result is an embarrassment and setback to the EU, but not a blow in a sense that will cause a change in EU behavior.
Potentially, it could impede implementation of the agreement with Ukraine. The government in the Netherlands is obliged now, because the threshold of 30% was reached, to take into account the referendum. In other words, the result of the referendum is not binding, but the government must consider the result. And the government has already said that it will consider its ratification of the agreement and perhaps seek certain changes to the agreement. But the agreement is quite complicated and quite far-reaching, so I think the Dutch government could tweak the agreement without fundamentally affecting the agreement.
Would that necessitate another referendum, or would they just ignore the people?
No, they wouldn't ignore the people. They would be seen to be responsive to the people by saying, we understand your concerns, we're taking those into account, we are going back to our partners in the European Union, and we're going to discuss this also with the government in Ukraine, and we will make certain changes to the agreement, taking into account what we think are the concerns of the Dutch people. But the agreement itself will not fundamentally be altered.
The referendum was the first in the Netherlands since the 2005 rejection of the EU constitution. Is there a strong Eurosceptic view in the Netherlands?
There is, and what's surprising and somewhat concerning about it is that the Netherlands is a founding member of the original European community, and support in the Netherlands for European integration has historically been strong. But what we see in the Netherlands, as elsewhere throughout the European Union over the last 10 to 15 years, is an increasing Euroscepticism, an increasing concern on the part of ordinary citizens about the nature of European integration, about the value which the European Union delivers, about whether the European Union solves problems anymore or is perhaps the problem itself, and also concern about certain aspects of European Union policy. I think a major concern for many people in Western Europe has been what they see as the too rapid expansion of the European Union into Central and Eastern Europe. And behind the result in the Netherlands, I think, was concern amongst Dutch voters that what the agreement with Ukraine signaled was, in fact, the possibility eventually of Ukrainian membership in the European Union. And I think that concerns a lot of people in Western Europe.
Desmond Dynan of George Mason University. He says among many Western Europeans, there's been a headlong rush to expand the EU, with 10 Central and Eastern European countries granted membership in the past decade, and the perception is that many were not ready to join. He also says Europe's two current crises, dealing with migration and the euro, have had a major impact on the success of European integration and cohesion. He says they're fueling what he perceives as a growing Euroscepticism. Dynan says the Dutch vote will have only a slight impact on June's United Kingdom EU referendum. But he says the re-imposition of border controls is a retrograde development, underscoring the fact that the EU faces its greatest challenge in its post-war history. Well, as we heard, today is World Health Day, and among the greatest medical threats is diabetes. The World Health Organization reports 422 million adults are living with diabetes, a four-fold increase over 1980 figures. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of WHO's Global Report on Diabetes in Geneva.
The release of this report in advance of World Health Day is meant as a call to global action to halt the rise of type 2 diabetes, which is killing 1.5 million people a year. The World Health Organization estimates 43% of these deaths occur prematurely before the age of 70. The UN agency says diabetes is no longer a disease of the wealthy. Most cases now are found in middle and low income countries. The WHO says the highest rates are in the Middle East, Southeast Asia, and the Western Pacific. The WHO report says the dramatic rise of this deadly disease is largely due to the increasing number of overweight and obese people. It reports more than one in three adults is overweight and more than one in 10 is obese. Etienne Krug is the director of WHO's Department for Management of Noncommunicable Diseases. He says diabetics will suffer complications from the disease if it is not detected in a timely manner and treated.
People with diabetes have a 2 to 3 times higher risk of cardiovascular disease. They have a 10 to 20 times higher risk of lower limb amputation. Diabetes is an important cause of blindness through diabetic retinopathy and an important cause of end-stage renal disease.
Krug tells VOA the economic cost of diabetes can be catastrophic for both the individual and society. He notes that monthly insulin treatment, which is a question of life and death for many patients, can be expensive.
We know that just the annual direct medical costs exceed $827 billion every year. So it's a very, very vast, large number. And that is not taking into account many other types of costs, such as lost productivity, et cetera, et cetera.
The UN agency says adopting a healthy lifestyle can prevent the majority of cases. The report's recommendations include eating healthier, engaging in more physical activity, and avoiding excessive weight gain. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Country music great Merle Haggard has died. He passed away at his home in California on Wednesday. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Jay Orr of the Country Music Hall of Fame in Nashville, Tennessee, about the life and legacy of Merle Haggard.
One of the legends of country music, one of the pillars of country music, Merle Haggard passed away, ironically, on his 79th birthday. Merle is one of those people that people point to as, if I could be like him, I would be satisfied with my career. What was his contribution and what do you think his legacy will be?
Merle was one of the greats of country music. It's hard to sum up his achievement in the field, but he was a songwriter. He was a performer. He was a musician. He stood shoulder to shoulder with the people we think of as the greats of the genre, people like Hank Williams, Willie Nelson, Kris Kristofferson, and Johnny Cash. But he really embodied the country music singer-songwriter. In the museum here, the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum, we have what we call our core exhibit that tells the story of country music. And we've called the core exhibit, Sing Me Back Home, A Journey Through Country Music. Of course, Sing Me Back Home is a Merle Haggard song. He connects with the story that we tell in a great and important way.
Now, he was a very versatile songwriter. He could write about songs about broken hearts, like I think about Silver Wings or Today I Started Loving You Again. He also did some stuff that was autobiographical, things like Mama Tried or Hungry Eyes, because he grew up literally in a railroad car turned into a house in California, And he used that. He used his own life experience to write these songs that are just as poignant today as they were when he first penned them.
Well, you said it yourself, David. That's really true. He drew from his own experience, and he drew from the experience of working men and women in America. I think of a song like Working Man Blues, which is a phrase that people use to describe country music. Working man's blues or blue-collar blues. He really was in touch, much like Woody Guthrie, another, you know, Merle's roots were in Oklahoma, although he grew up in California. Woody Guthrie the same way, and in the same way that Woody Guthrie sang about people of the soil, Merle did as well. And we invited Merle to be our artist in residence. He said, "What do I have to do?" And I said, "Well, one thing is you should not do the same thing on two consecutive nights." He said, "I never do the same thing on two consecutive nights."
And I'm proud to be an Okie from Muskogee, the place where even squares can have a ball.
We still wave old glory down at the courthouse.
White lightning still the biggest thrill of all.
And white lightning still the biggest thrill of all.
That is the music of the late Merle Haggard, and earlier we heard from Jay Orr of the Country Music Hall of Fame in Nashville. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking at the conclusion of the recent nuclear security summit in Washington, President Barack Obama pointed to the nuclear deal agreed to by Iran, the European Union, and the P5 plus one countries, the JCPOA, as one of the top accomplishments in his administration's drive to halt the spread of nuclear weapons. Regarding the JCPOA, Mr. Obama said his first priority had been to make sure that Iran's nuclear weapons program was stopped and that material that would have given Iran a very short breakout capacity was shipped out of the country. That has happened, he said. President Obama noted that so far, Iran's leaders have lived up to the JCPOA to the letter.
They have, in fact, based on the presentations that were made by the IAEA this morning to the P5 plus one, followed the implementation steps that were laid out. And as a consequence, sanctions related to their nuclear program have been brought down.
Mr. Obama said that Iran does face a challenge in getting businesses to feel comfortable that the JCPOA is holding and that there are no longer risks due to nuclear sanctions if companies do business with Iran. President Obama pledged to address some of the concerns Iran has expressed over this issue. But President Obama cautioned that the spirit of the JCPOA involves Iran also sending signals to the world community and businesses that it is not going to be engaging in a range of provocative actions that might scare business off.
When they launch ballistic missiles with slogans calling for the destruction of Israel, that makes businesses nervous. If Iran continues to ship missiles to Hezbollah, that gets businesses nervous.
President Obama said that the United States has a responsibility to provide clarity about the rules that govern so that the Iranian people can benefit from an improved economic situation. But, Mr. Obama stressed, Iran has to understand what every country in the world understands, which is businesses want to go where they feel safe, where they don't see massive controversy, where they can be confident that transactions are going to operate normally.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.